gestured to the baby fastened to her breast. I'm sitting here in the park, half naked, and I don't even care who sees, and what's worse is that nobody is even trying to look. The woman detached her sleeping baby from her nipple and ran a soft finger over his pudgy cheek. These breasts used to make things happen, you know? These breasts didn't put anybody to sleep. Melody couldn't help but stare a little at the prominent veins running beneath the woman's fair skin, the darkened, engorged nipple. She'd tried to breastfeed the twins, had wanted to so badly, but had given up after 6 weeks, unable to get them on any kind of schedule and nearly out of her mind with a lack of sleep. She watched the other mom hook her nursing bra closed and hoist the infant up on her shoulder, rhythmically thumping his back to elicit a burp. I used to read 3 newspapers every morning. 3. Her voice was softer now so as not to disturb the baby. You know where I get all my news now? Fucking Oprah. Her expression was rueful but also resigned, her fingers making small circles on the baby's back. What can you do? This is temporary, right? Melody never knew how to join those conversations, so she didn't. She'd sit and smile and try to nod knowingly. But what she would have said if she could have mustered the nerve was that before her daughters were born, she was nothing. She was a secretary, a typist, someone who blew off college because her father died the fall of her senior year of high school and her mother was checked out, and Melody herself was paralyzed with confusion and grief, not to mention her kind of shitty grades. But then one day, Walter sat next to her in their company cafeteria. He introduced himself and handed her a piece of chocolate cake, saying it was the last one and he'd grabbed it for her because he'd noticed she usually allowed herself a slice on Fridays. When Walt asked her out for pizza and a movie and only months later asked her to be his wife, and only a year after that she became a mother to not one but 2 brilliantly beautiful baby girls, well, that was something. Then she became someone. She leaned back and closed her eyes. Maybe she could just doze for a minute or two. She thought about Nora's coat and wondered if a new set of buttons would help. Something decorative, wooden or pewter or maybe a colorful glass button, emerald green maybe. She could do that. She could afford 2 sets of new buttons. Sometimes a small change could make all the difference. Chapter 13. After they saw Leo in the park, it took another 3 weeks for Nora to coerce Louisa out again, and that was the day Simone spotted them leaving and asked if she could join. I thought I saw you 2 skipping out of this particular ring of hell a few weeks ago, she said, stopping on the front steps of the building to light a cigarette. I live around here. Want to go to my apartment? In the weeks since then, whenever they skipped class, Simone joined them, and she'd completely taken over their weekly excursions. It was winter, and the only thing Louisa and Nora ever did now was go to the American Museum of Natural History because Simone had a family membership card, and it was free, or hang out at Simone's apartment, which was always empty because both of her parents were attorneys who almost always went into the office on Saturdays. Louisa was sick of it. She wasn't only sick of the deceit. She was certain it was just a matter of time before they were caught, and then what? She was sick of Simone's apartment, and even sick of the museum, a place she used to love because it was one of their family's special destinations, one of the few Melody-approved field trips into New York, and what had seemed gleaming and exotic all through their childhoods, rooms with sharks and dinosaurs and cases of gemstones, live butterflies, had been dulled over the past few months, tainted with familiarity and guilt and boredom. And then there was Simone, the beautiful African-American girl who always sat in the front row and finished her work before everybody else and wandered the room offering help to those who wanted it. She was a junior in high school, too, and Louisa had overheard the instructor say that Simone could probably get a perfect SAT score without too much effort. Probably, Simone had said, shrugging. Something about her made Louisa nervous. She seemed so much older than they were. She supposed it was just that Simone had grown up in Manhattan and was braver, more sophisticated. And she was free with her opinions of Nora and Louisa in a way that was discomforting. Every Saturday at the start of their outing, she'd appraise Nora and Louisa, looking them up and down and pronouncing judgment on each piece of clothing and accessory. No, yes, God, no, 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 that is actually nice. Please don't wear that again. When she laughed, she threw back her head and hooted a little and was so loud people turned to stare. She smoked. She applied bright orange lipstick without even looking in a mirror, flicking a pinky into the cleft of her upper lip and the corners to be sure it was perfect. "This is my signature color," she told them, snapping the tube of lipstick shut and tucking it into her back pocket. "Black women can wear these shades. Don't you two even think about it." That day she'd had her long braids piled on top of her head in a coiled bun, adding inches to her already imposing height, elongating her face, which could be aloof or curious depending on her mood. She wore fitted tees made out of some kind of diaphanous cotton that left nothing above the waist to be curious about. Her bras, the kind with the molded cup designed to enhance cleavage, were brightly colored and lacy and clearly visible under everything she wore. Melody still shopped for most of Nora's and Louisa's clothing, buying them serviceable lingerie on sale that sometimes verged on cute, prints of puppies or handbags or seashells, but never veered toward sexy. Occasionally, Simone would point to something one of them was wearing and say, "That is adorable," not meaning it as a compliment. As far as Louisa could decipher, adorable in Simone's lexicon was a combination of stupid and tacky. Simone was also fiercely critical of everything that was, to use her favorite insult, popular. Her bright orange mouth twisting the word into an insult. If Simone liked something, it was tight, which made no sense to Louisa. "Shouldn't tight be negative?" she asked Nora. "As in uncomfortable, constrained, restricting, as in these old pants are tight?" "Not everything's an SAT word," Nora said in a drawl Louisa had never heard her employ before, and which made her sound exactly like Simone. According to Simone, lots of the twins' favorite songs or television shows or movies were popular. And just like that, things Nora and Louisa had enjoyed became tainted, at least for one of them. Louisa had been sitting on the linoleum floor in the museum with her sketch pad for almost an hour, and the leg bent beneath her had started to go numb. She stood awkwardly and tried to stomp the feeling back into her thigh and butt, which were tingling uncomfortably. She limped back and forth under the sign for the entrance to the small corridor where she'd been drawing, the Leonard C. Sanford Hall of North American Birds. She liked that part of the museum for a bunch of reasons. First, it was named after a Leonard, and so was she, after the grandfather she'd never met. Nora was named after their father's father, Norman. She liked that the hall wasn't nearly as crowded as the more popular exhibits, the dinosaurs or the blue whale. On a weekend, those rooms were nearly impossible to navigate, never mind finding a spot to sit in peace with her sketchpad. North American Birds was a dated, musty exhibit of field specimens tacked onto walls behind glass. It was more a corridor to pass through than a destination. And she loved the bird specimens, even if they were old-fashioned and a little creepy. Her favorite case was the one displaying swallows, flycatchers, and larks, because the birds were in flight and almost looked alive. Her least favorite, herons, ibises, and swans, because the large birds looked awkward and uncomfortable. Purely for vernacular, she loved the case she was sitting in front of now. Wrens, nuthatches, creepers, titmice, mimic thrushes, jays, and crows. She wished she knew what a mimic thrush mimicked and whether titmice ate mice. She supposed she could Google, but she preferred to wonder. But even in the relatively sparsely populated corridor, she was rarely left alone. People still constantly looked over her shoulder and asked questions about what she was drawing or why, or even worse, just stood watching in awkward silence. And the kids, pestering her nonstop and asking if they could draw too. Their parents were just as bad. "Maybe if you ask nicely," one mother had said to her son while Louisa was trying to sketch the larks in flight right before her leg went numb. "This nice lady will share her paper and show you how to draw." "These aren't for kids," Louisa said sharply, picking up her charcoal pencils and pastels from the floor.
"How come she won't share?" the little boy whined.
"I don't know, honey," his mother said. "Not everyone is a good sharer like you." "Jesus," Louisa said, slamming her pad shut. The mother threw her a dirty look and walked away. Louisa started to gather the sheets of paper on the floor around her. One wasn't terrible. It was of a little boy who'd thrown a tantrum after his father wouldn't buy him a stuffed seal in the gift shop. He'd flung himself to the ground and buried his head in his arms, shoulders heaving. Louisa had sketched him quickly, and she'd managed to capture the bereft set of his shoulders, his legs swinging in frustration, how one of his hands reached out, fingers splayed, toward the door of the toy shop where his object of desire was cruelly out of reach.
"Silly, silly," the boy had wailed,
his father finally having to carry him kicking and screaming into a nearby restroom. The other drawings of people, quickly sketched as she watched visitors moving through the long halls, weren't exactly embarrassing, but they weren't great. She never got the proportion of features to face exactly right. The reason the little boy came out better, she knew, was because his face was concealed. She didn't want to think about what it meant that she couldn't draw eyes, the windows to the soul, the most important thing an artist had to master. It was not lost on her that all the birds in the Leonard C. Sanford Hall were eyeless, tiny bits of cotton inserted in their eye sockets. "So, are you going to art school?" Simone had asked once after Louisa let her look at some of her sketches. "No," Louisa said. She'd mentioned art school once, and her mother had blanched. Art school, to Melody, was not really school.
"Why not?" Simone said.
"Because I want to get a good general education," Louisa said, mimicking Melody's words. "Art school is more like trade school."
"What's wrong with trade school?"
Louisa laughed nervously. She wasn't sure if Simone was being serious or sarcastic.
"I mean it," Simone said, still paging through Louisa's drawings. "Medical school is trade school. So is law school."
"But that's graduate school. It's different," Nora said. Sometimes she thought Simone picked on Louisa a little.
"True," Simone said agreeably. "But if you love art and you want to draw or paint, why wouldn't you go to a place where you can get better doing the thing you love?"
"Some of the schools we've looked at have excellent art programs," Louisa said.
"How many have you looked at?"
14, Nora said. Simone burst out laughing. "You've looked at 14 colleges already?"
"It's fun. We like it," Louisa said.
She knew she sounded defensive, and in truth she'd be happy to never look at another college again. "It's good to be able to compare, so we know which ones are the right fit."
Simone shook her head and snorted a little.
"Wow.
You all are seriously drinking the admissions Kool-Aid."
She plucked one of the drawings from the pile and handed it to Louisa. It was one of her favorites, a soft pastel of the front of the museum at dusk. She'd done it quickly and kept the rendering loose. The museum looked more like a mountain than a building, and the street beneath with its streaming cars resembled a rushing river of movement and color.
"This is really beautiful," Simone said, sounding more sincere than Louisa had ever heard her.
"I know exactly what it is. It's realistic in that way, but it's also kind of abstract."
She turned the page vertically.
"Look, it even works from this angle. The perspective, I mean."
Louisa was surprised and pleased to see she was right. Simone handed the drawing back to Louisa.
This is tight. Frame it. You should do more like that one.
And you should really look at Pratt and Parsons. RISD, too. I'll think of some more places for your list.
Louisa checked her watch. It was late, and she had to find Simone and Nora, who always seemed to lose track of time. They'd agreed to meet in the Hall of Pacific Peoples, which appeared to be empty except for a French family gathered around the fiberglass replica of an Easter Island head that loomed over one end of the room. As Louisa approached, they asked her to take their picture with one of their phones, and thanked her profusely when she showed them a shot where everyone was smiling, eyes open. She decided to take a quick look at the Margaret Mead display, which she loved. As she headed toward the glass cases, she passed by a small, dark corridor, and then backed up, embarrassed, because she'd interrupted a couple in an intimate embrace. Only to register before she turned around that one of the couple was wearing red, Swedish perforated clogs, just like hers. And Nora's. Louisa felt her neck and face become feverish. She wanted to run, but she couldn't move. Nora was leaning against the wall, and her shirt was unbuttoned to the waist. Simone's hands were moving under the shirt. Nora's eyes were closed, her arms limp at her sides. Louisa could see Simone's hand moving upward toward Nora's white utilitarian bra.
"Please," Louisa heard Nora say, and then watched as Simone's thumb stroked Nora's nipple through the worn cotton.
Both women groaned. Louisa turned and ran. Chapter 14. Corporal Vinnie Massaro knew that the kids who came into his father's pizza place called him RoboCop. Whatever. One of these days he was going to reach out and grab one of them with the claw at the end of his terrifyingly complicated prosthetic arm, probably the chubby redhead. He'd wipe the smirk off that kid's face. Maybe he'd grab him with his good arm, his flesh-and-blood arm, and let the kid dangle a few inches off the ground while he stroked his fat, freckled cheek with one steel finger, making him cry and beg for mercy, apologizing through heaving sobs. Vinnie could see the bubbles of snot now. Stop. Rewind. This was not the type of imaginary scenario Vinnie was supposed to indulge. It was not positive or affirming. It was not how he'd been instructed to manage his anger. Stop and rewind was one of the techniques he was supposed to employ, according to his anger therapist, who shouldn't be confused with his physical therapist or his prosthetic therapist or the occupational therapist, who had been the one to suggest anger management when Vinnie used the metal pincers of his brand new government-financed limb to eviscerate a toy duck into a million bits of foam the day he couldn't manage to lift and lower the yellow ducky even once. Vinnie took a deep breath, closed his eyes. Rewind. 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 He pictured himself walking over to the table of kids and laughing along with them, showing them his arm, genially explaining how sophisticated the technology was, how certain of his nerve endings had been surgically regenerated so that he could actually control the artificial limb with his brain. "I guess I am RoboCop," he'd say, "part man, part robot." "Wow," the kids would say, "can we touch it?" "Sure," Vinnie would reply, then laugh and cuff one of them lightly on the shoulder with the real arm. "Go ahead," he'd say, "touch it. It's as good as my old arm. It doesn't get hot or cold or cut or bruised. It's better than the old arm." Better, that is, unless you were Amy, Vinnie's ex-fiance, in which case the new arm was definitely not better than the old arm. If you were Amy, you'd pretend to be fine with the new arm, plaster a grim smile on your face, spout platitudes like, "It's what's on the inside that counts," until the day when Vinnie, finally starting to feel at ease, casually put his arm around her waist, and she flinched. Vinnie didn't feel the flinch, of course. "Hey, kids, the new arm doesn't feel betrayal." But he saw it.
he wasn't blind. Worse, because he'd unthinkingly touched her with the robot arm, he didn't even get the pleasure of feeling his fingers sink a little into the soft ribbon of flesh above her hips that he loved so much. Didn't get to feel anything before he saw her recoil and then look at him, petrified and... stop. Rewind. In his mind, he went back to talking to the kids at the table and imagined how even the redhead would stop snickering, how they'd all be impressed when he picked up the tiny, plastic, greasy salt shaker. Not the bigger cardboard container of garlic salt, whose mere presence he found offensive. Don't get him started on how the Mexicans in the neighborhood covered their perfectly seasoned pizza with the garlic salt, and sometimes even hot sauce that they'd take out of their pockets in little travel bottles. As if his grandfather, whose recipe Vinny and his father Vito still followed, hadn't learned to make tomato sauce in Naples where they fucking invented tomato sauce. Stop. He'd pick up the real salt shaker and daintily shake a few grains into his fleshy palm, throwing them over his left shoulder to thwart the devil like his Nana taught him. The kids would applaud. Yeah, Vinny would say, winding up his demonstration with something positive and forward-looking to avoid bitter and self-loathing. I'm one of the lucky ones, he'd say, winking at them like he was a goddamn movie star. Here was the thing. Vinny was one of the lucky ones, and he knew it. He could have lost more than one limb. He could be dead. When the IED exploded, he could have been walking on the left side of the path instead of the right, like his buddy Justin, who was alive, but not. Traumatic brain injury, they called it, instead of what it was, fucking retarded. Justin, back home in Virginia, sitting and drooling in front of a television set all day, every day, bathed by his mother, spoon-fed by his father, wheeled out onto the porch for a little sun and fresh air so the neighbors could peer out their windows and feel blessed, shake their heads and say, "There but for the grace of God." Justin carried to bed by his brother every night, only to wake up the next day and start the whole depressing regimen all over again until he finally did kick it and was out of his misery for good. Justin, who had been 5 measly days away from completing his tour and going home. Whole. So yes, Vinny was lucky. Fortunate. He was still strong, mostly healthy. He could take over the family businesses whenever he wanted. Not only the pizza place, but also a nice Italian grocery across the street, mostly imports, that his grandfather had opened on Arthur Avenue back when the neighborhood was all Italian, only Italian, before the ever-increasing influx of Mexican families over the decades. He had family around who were helpful and supportive. Fuck Amy. Maybe he got too angry sometimes, but he was working on it. He was trying. Now that the kids had left the pizza joint, snickering at him, he knew it. He was a little calmer. Calmer, that is, until he saw Matilda Rodriguez coming down the street, and his fury smoldered anew because there she was, walking down the street, again on the crutches, swinging herself around like she was the fucking queen of fucking Sheba and Arthur Avenue in the Bronx was her kingdom. Waiting for people to move out of her way, hold doors open for her, offer to carry her bags. What was next, a rickshaw? A fucking velvet cape over an icy puddle? It wasn't right. She should be walking. He put his head down, took a deep breath, rewind, rewind, rewind. He tried to employ an imaging technique using a positive historical frame of reference. He thought about when he met Matilda, during her first weeks at the rehab center when he was there doing the tedious work of managing his new arm. He thought about how upbeat and determined and flirtatious she'd been then. Not just with him, he wasn't an idiot, with everyone. But still, it had been nice. How she sang a lot and called everyone mommy or papi, no matter his or her age in relation to hers. He remembered her swinging dark hair and bright smile, which reminded him about a particular pink sweater she wore during those first weeks. He thought about how that pink sweater would pull across her breasts when she was positioned on the crutches, making it apparent that she hadn't bothered with a bra, riding up to reveal her tiny waist. He thought about how he might like to touch that pink sweater, which made him think of his mechanical arm and how if he did touch the sweater, the material might snag and maybe even rip and start to unravel. Matilda would look down at her damaged sweater and her face would fill with regret and maybe even a little disgust. And then she would look back at him with her lovely almond-shaped eyes and, he could see it perfectly, they'd fill with pity.
Corporal!
Matilda in the doorway of the pizza place now. She was with her cousin, Fernando, the one who'd visited her repeatedly in rehab when he was on break from law school. He was carrying her purse and all her grocery bags. Her eyes were watery with cold, and her smile was tentative. She knew how Vinny felt about the crutches, about her not using the prosthesis.
"I'm so hungry, I swear I could eat 5 slices right now," she said, moving into the restaurant toward one of the booths.
He watched Fernando help her sit and get comfortable, slide her crutches beneath the table. Vinny concentrated on a non-judgmental greeting. He counted to 10 before he approached, tucking the damp dish towel he carried into the waistband of his jeans. Matilda sat and looked up nervously as he came closer, wiping her slightly runny nose with a Vito's pizzeria napkin. He leaned a little on the table with his good hand, moved his face closer to hers.
"Where the fuck is your foot?" he said.
Chapter 15. The night of the accident, the previous summer, Leo had sat in the emergency room bracingly, horrifyingly alert, hungover, petrified. He kept replaying the moment of the crash, Matilda's screams, and the far more frightening moment when she'd stopped screaming and he was afraid she was dead. They were in adjacent rooms in the ER, he and Matilda. He could hear her occasional moans and the doctors talking about the possibility of reattachment. Her right foot had been nearly severed at the ankle. A hospital translator was talking to her parents. An old family friend from the sheriff's department had made a call to George Plum from the accident site around the same time that Leo had called B. George and B left the wedding and arrived at the hospital together. George immediately discussed containment with Leo.
"I don't care what you remember," he said to him softly. "At this moment, you don't remember anything. You've had a head trauma."
He nodded toward Leo's bleeding chin.
"Got it."
Leo was watching B listen through the curtain, not knowing whether to hope that her Spanish was still strong, or had, along with many of her talents, diminished to ineffectual. She was listening hard, her head was bent, and Leo noticed that the tops of her shoulders were slightly sunburned. Her dress, like almost everything she owned, was vintage, short, black, and sleeveless, and she was clutching herself, as if trying to stay warm in the chill of the air-conditioned hospital. B wasn't cold. She was concentrating on understanding as much of the conversation as possible, which was pretty much everything. She was losing some medical terms, but she understood when the translator explained to Matilda's parents the slim possibility of a successful reattachment. He detailed the complications, the chances of rejection, the powerful pharmaceuticals and lengthy hospitalization and rehabilitation Matilda would need in the coming weeks and months. The very, very long road ahead with a reattachment that could still result in an eventual amputation. Matilda's father told the translator they had no insurance, that they were, in fact, in the country illegally. "That doesn't matter right now," she heard the translator say, his tone urgent but kind. "You are entitled to the proper treatment." One of the nurses gently interrupted.
"We don't have much time to decide if you want to reattach. We'd need to prepare the foot."
B could hear Matilda's mother address the doctor and her husband in heavily accented English.
"What is life without a foot?" she said.
The anguish in her voice was harrowing.
"What kind of future will she have? How will she walk?"
Will she work?
No, Mommy, no.
Matilda spoke from the bed, her voice slurred and dreamy from shock and morphine.
The man from the car is going to help me. He knows people. Music people. It was just an accident, a bad accident. He is going to help me. No more waitressing.
Your music?
The mother said, incredulous. She reverted to Spanish, her tone bitter and scared.
You lose your foot and this man is going to make you a star.
I need to get out of here,
Matilda pleaded. The translator was speaking to the doctor, but B couldn't make out what they were saying. B walked over to Leo, who was still clutching a bloody piece of Matilda's white blouse in his hands. The nurse had cleaned the wound and left to get sutures so she could stitch Leo's chin. George pointed to the curtain. Pick up anything interesting? B hesitated. What she'd just heard wasn't her business. The information was not hers to pass along. She knew George. B?
Kind of, B said. They're deciding whether to amputate.
George sighed. Not great news. B turned to Leo. In the fluorescent light of the ER, chin split, eyes bloodshot and watery, gaze unfocused, he looked beaten and scared. He tried to smile. He looked for a minute like a little boy, and she took his hand.
I don't know what happened, he said to her. One minute we were going.
Shh! George stopped Leo by raising a palm. Time for all that later. Leo held B's hand so tightly her fingers were numb. Careful, Superman, she said, wriggling her fingers and loosening his grip a little.
Superman. Right.
Leo lightly touched his chin and winced.
I could use Superman right now. Have him fly and reverse the Earth's rotation to go back in time.
Before the really dry crab cakes were passed, B said, trying to distract Leo from the crying she could hear on the other side of the curtain.
More like to early 2002, he said.
That sounded good to B. 2002. The year before he sold Speakeasy Media and met Victoria. Tuck still alive, her book newly published. The year that was the dividing line, in B's mind, of the Leo she loved, the Leo who was one of her closest friends, gradually disappearing and morphing into someone unrecognizable. Leo looked like he might cry. She was scared for him.
How did I get here? He said.
She was trying not to stare at the split in his chin. He was going to have a scar.
How did I fuck up this badly?
In spite of the circumstances, B's heart billowed to hear something approaching self-reflection and regret, something hinting at an apology coming from Leo. It had been a long time. It's going to be okay, she said, feeling helpless.
I don't know about that, Leo said.
There was a slight commotion on the other side of the curtain. The parents seemed to be arguing in Spanish, and the translator was trying to intervene.
I think it might be the furthest thing from okay, he said.
B put her hand on Leo's back, and he leaned into her a little. She motioned George closer and spoke softly and quickly before she could change her mind. I heard something else.
What? George said.
The parents are undocumented. George smiled for the first time since arriving at the ER. That is much better news. Good work. He pointed a finger at Leo. This is still going to cost you a fucking fortune, but I can use this. From the other side of the curtain, Matilda's voice rose above the ongoing bickering, louder and more insistent.
Tómalo, mami. Tómalo.
Tómalo. Take it. Take the foot.
Then the translator speaking to the surgeon.
They want you to amputate.
I think that's the right decision, the surgeon said. We'll get a clean cut. Leave as much bone as possible. Chapter 16.
morning, West 76th Street. B was sitting in the pre-sunrise dark, holding a cup of chamomile tea with both hands, waiting for the heat from her favorite mug, the one she'd gotten the lone year she'd capitulated during the public radio fundraising drive and pledged a premium, to warm her stiffened fingers. The kitchen table was in its winter location, awkwardly wedged into an interior corner, partly blocking the doorway to the living room, but well away from the exposed wall and the two battered windows that looked out onto an air shaft populated by a disturbing number of pigeons, and God only knew how many rodents. She knew she was lucky to have windows in the kitchen. Was lucky, in fact, to have a kitchen big enough to house a table. But the rope sash windows were as insulating as a piece of cling wrap. The abraded wood would swell in the summer heat, and the layers of old paint and putty would become malleable and gummy, making the windows impossible to open. In the winter, the wood would shrink, letting in preposterous amounts of cold air. Sitting wrapped in a bulky sweater over her nightgown, she waited for the telltale hiss and bang of the radiator pipes, signaling 6:30 a.m., and only 10 more minutes until the room was decently warmed. She was up too early. It was cold. B couldn't sleep for two reasons. The first was because of the horrible party at Celia's. The second was no doubt directly related to the first. She'd had an upsetting dream about Tuck. She didn't dream of him often, which was good, because he was usually tense and frustrated in her dreams. Dream Tucker couldn't speak, just as he'd been at the end of his life after the stroke. Sometimes he'd write something down in the dream, but she could never read it. Either the words were blurred, or she kept misplacing the piece of paper, or, on the rare occasion she did manage to read what he'd written, she could never remember what it was when she woke in the morning. Sometimes the dreams clung to B all day, leaving her unsettled and jittery, gloomy, like today. She wondered why a relationship that in real life had been so sustaining and even-keeled was so fraught in her dream life. She decided that Tucker represented the part of her unconscious that struggled with writing, and that made perfect sense to her. Why the deep recesses of her mind and soul would seize on Tucker as the right vehicle to deliver her own dissatisfaction to herself. He'd been dead for almost 3 years, and she still thought of him constantly. Mostly as he was when she first met him, standing in front of a classroom reading poetry to his students, mesmerizing them with his sonorous voice, the voice he'd so cruelly lost use of at the end. B had taken a class with Tucker after her book came out, after a year in Seville where she found herself so disoriented and adrift that she did little else than sit in tapas bars, smoking and sipping sherry, practicing her Spanish and writing funny postcards to her friends. She came home nearly fluent but empty-handed in terms of word count. "How about joining a writing group or taking a class?" Stephanie had suggested, not concerned yet. "A class?" B said. "Not a fiction class, something else. Poetry, nonfiction. Just to get the wheels greased. It might be fun." "Like, go to the New School and sign up for Introduction to Poetry?" B was pissed. She had an MFA. "No, of course not. Something at your level. Like, how about Tucker McMillan's class at Columbia? He's amazing. You could audit." B ignored Stephanie's suggestion, only to find herself a few days later at a party standing before Tucker. She was mesmerized. He was appealingly craggy in the way of some older men who seemed to finally grow into their generous features in middle age. She'd seen pictures of him when he was younger and thinner and seemed burdened by his own physicality. Nose too large, mouth too generous, ears too wide. But when she met him, some alchemy of time and girth and weathering of his face made him beautiful. And his voice. It was one of the biggest regrets of her life, and that was saying something. That she didn't have his voice on tape anywhere. "Ah, Beatrice Plum," he'd said.
taking one of her hands in both of his and giving her his full attention.
As pretty as your picture.
B hadn't known then if he was making fun of her. It was shortly after the glittery piece came out, and although the photographer had taken what felt like hundreds of pictures of her for that article, at a desk, leaning against a window, curled in a chair, he'd chosen to use one of maybe three shots he'd snapped at the very end of the day when she was exhausted and had collapsed on her bed for a minute while he was changing lenses. "Hold it right there," he'd said, and had stood on a chair at the end of the bed and shot her from above, reclining, arms stretched to her side, looking sleepy and patently alluring. She had been flirting with the photographer a little, but not with the world. The picture had been ridiculed on various media sites, written about more than anything she said in the article. She was still angry about that stupid photo, which in any context other than work she would have quite liked. "Not the one I would have chosen," she'd said, trying to sound dismissive but not defensive.
"Why on earth not?"
Tuck stared at her so intently she backed up a few steps.
"The yellow dress? The parasol? Those hanging ducks? I thought it was brilliant. Strong."
"Oh," she said, relieved. "I like that photo, too."
"I didn't know there were others," he said. "I'll have to find them."
"That's the best one," she said. She could feel her face and neck flush and tried to back away. His stare was so direct. It was exhilarating.
"Stay for a bit."
He put his hand on her arm and her entire being lit up.
"Everyone here is dull. Stay and tell me an interesting story."
She showed up in his class the following week and every week after that for the rest of the year. She was a good student, serious and hard-working, quiet and unassuming. She wasn't a great poet, but Stephanie had been right. It was fun to do something new, something without a particular result or pressure to perform attached. B waited until she was no longer Tucker's student to sleep with him. He assumed her reluctance was because he was almost 20 years older, married with grown children. But it wasn't any of those things. B simply didn't want to have sex with the teacher, didn't want that to be the beginning of their story, and by then, when it wasn't a question of if but when they would be together, it was clear to both of them that they would, in fact, have a story. Or at least that was the narrative she wove for Tucker, and it was partly true. But something else was true, too. She loved the power his desire afforded her. Her inability to produce anything significant of the novel made her feel like such an imposter, frightened even. And his desire was a balm. She loved the secret of what they were surely going to do. She flirted with him mercilessly at the beginning, requesting private conferences that she dressed for as if she was going to be undressed, even though she knew she wasn't. She carried his lust around like a magic coin in her pocket that she could spend when she decided she was ready. He acquired the apartment on the Upper West Side shortly after they began their affair, wanting a place where he could spend time with her that was not the cockroach-infested studio she rented on the Lower East Side with the occasional junkie passed out in the lobby. He would have left his wife. His kids were grown, and his wife taught in Dublin most of the year. But B liked their arrangement. She needed solitude. When she grouped the passing years into logical increments, it didn't feel so confounding. The story collection published, and then a year in Seville, trying, failing, to write what she was calling her Bildungsroman. The year after Seville, when she returned to New York and accepted every invite, readings, conferences, interviews, panels, and met Tuck. The following year, when Tuck made her decline every invite because she was writing, finally, and the two subsequent years, still writing, when the invite stopped. The year she set the book aside and went to work with Paul Underwood because her advance was long spent. The year she began a new draft, a spiritual meditation of self-discovery in Seville, and then threw that away and went back to the Bildungsroman, Tucker's stroke and aftermath. 2 years when she tended to him and loved him and didn't write. His death, and the year she spent broken by grief and trying, once and for all, to salvage the novel. Now a combination of the first and second. A not very spiritual, unwieldy coming-of-age disaster. Last year, when she gave it up for good. 11 years of life and heartbreak and work and failed paragraphs. When she broke it down like that, it didn't seem so inexplicable. But what had she done every day? How had so many years of days gone by with nearly nothing to show outside of her work at Paper Fibers? No impressive salary. No children. No partner. She didn't even have a lousy pet. When Tucker died, she'd prepared to vacate the premises. It was the one time in her life she'd asked Francie for an advance on the nest. The only time in her life she'd even thought about the nest. She'd been stunned to receive the call from Tucker's attorney saying that the apartment was hers. She owned it outright. No mortgage. Tucker had worried about her. He was dismissive and dubious about the nebulous legal and financial structure of the nest. If you're really receiving a trust, there should be financial statements, an executor other than that loon of a mother, someone protecting your interests. She'd laughed at him. You do not understand the people you're talking about. This is just how my family works. Well, he'd been righter than she could have imagined. But thanks to him, she was okay with how and when and if Leo paid her back. The apartment was her nest, literally and metaphorically. She could stay there forever and manage on a modest income. She could sell and move someplace cheaper and live contentedly for a long time. Her family didn't know she owned, and wasn't anybody's business. B didn't dwell on the sum of cash Tucker also left her that was almost the exact amount of the portion of her advance she ended up having to pay back to her publisher. She preferred to think of it as an unsettling but lucky coincidence, and not what deep down she knew. Something Tucker recognized about her that she couldn't admit to herself. In last night's dream, Tucker was trying to tell her something important. He was jabbing furiously at a piece of paper with his good hand, and she was unable to make out the words, keep her eyes open and focus. She wondered, not for the first time, what he would think of her new work. She imagined he would approve. She stood and started straightening the mess on the table. Piles of notebooks, a handful of fountain pens and 2 bottles of ink, spools of merino wool and a hand spindle. B wanted to knit mittens for Melody's twins, had a few ideas about how to work the yarn. She picked up a small plastic bag of weed and her rolling papers. For a fleeting moment, she considered pretending it was still Sunday, getting high and knitting all day. She could call in sick. Paul wouldn't care. But she shouldn't. She couldn't. The radiator finally came on. She picked up the collected poems, Edna St. Vincent Millay, which she'd been reading since she awoke, thinking about Tuck and the poems he loved. Her fingers were so stiff she dropped all 758 pages and the book landed on the uneven hardwood floor with a boom and a healthy reverb. Before she even had a chance to brace herself, her downstairs neighbor started banging on his ceiling with a broomstick. He must carry that broom around the apartment with him, Bea thought. He must sleep with the damn broom. Did he even sleep? Or did he just sit, alert, clutching his broomstick, waiting for her auditory trespasses? Sorry, Harry, she yelled down through the radiator. She wasn't sorry. She disliked Harry, the 70-something widower who had always lived beneath her. Over the years, she'd realized that he was easily placated by a regular string of verbal apologies. The more she ignored his banging, the more hair-trigger the banging became. He'd pound when she dropped an apple, walked 2 steps in her stack-heeled boots. Harry was unpleasant, but she understood he was lonely and that their ritual comforted him, connected the noises of her life with the silence of his. And that even if the connection was relentless complaint and apology, Their call-and-response interaction settled him. Still, when was he going to get a little deaf? Too feeble to live on his own. Sometimes she fantasized about Harry dying and his family offering his apartment to her at a good price, well below market value. His son liked her. He called her sometimes to make sure Harry was doing okay. He lived in Chicago and didn't get back as often as he should. If she owned Harry's apartment, she would break through the floor, put in a simple spiral staircase like the people on the D-line down the hall had done. She'd have two floors and never have to move again. She could have a real office with an actual library. A guest room. Of course, even given some kind of ridiculously discounted insider price, she was in no position to buy anything. Not without the nest. Thinking about the nest made her think about her new pages. They were good. And then about Leo, which led back to Dream Tucker, and then she lit a joint. She wondered if Leo would stop by the office today. Maybe she'd ask him to lunch and take the plunge. She imagined handing him her new work and him reading and reacting with enthusiasm and excitement, saying, "I knew you had this in you." He'd been her biggest fan once. He'd watched out for her. She remembered when she was a freshman in high school, Leo a senior, and she'd let Connor Bellingham do things to her in the backseat of his car in the school parking lot after a meeting for the literary magazine. Leo was the editor. She was on staff. As she and Connor made out, she was simultaneously ecstatic and disappointed. Ecstatic because she'd had her eye on Connor for weeks. In addition to being handsome and popular and the class president, he'd submitted a shockingly good story to the magazine, and she hadn't been able to stop thinking about it, or him, or the last line of the story. Angry, and half in love with her, and tremendously sorry, I turned away. Disappointed because he refused to talk about writing. She didn't get it. Or how someone who, frankly, seemed a little doltish could write something so moving. "Have some more," he'd said, passing a small flask. The flask was gleaming silver and heavy in her hand. "Irish whiskey, my father's, the good stuff." "Some of my favorite writers are Irish," she'd said. "Yeah, well, I guarantee they drink this stuff." "Who are your favorite writers?" She smiled brightly, trying to get him to look at her and not out the window. Connor shook his head and laughed a little. "You have a one-track mind, you know that?" She shrugged and bent her nose to the flask and breathed deeply, imagining she was smelling Ireland, the surprisingly sweet fermentation and then the quick sting and heat, the heady aroma of peat and smoke. "To the old sod," she'd said, tipping the flask and taking a long sip. She liked it. Connor liked it. Connor liked her. She drank some more and they laughed, about what exactly she wasn't sure, and then they were kissing again. And his hands started moving lower, and she stiffened. "Relax," he said. She took a long sip from the flask and then another. She could feel something on the cold, steely surface. She held it up toward the window and in the light of a street lamp read the engraving. "What does Trapper mean?" she asked him. "Nothing. A silly nickname." "I think I should probably go." She realized she was getting very drunk. "Don't go," he said. "Look outside." Her voice sounded thick. "It's starting to snow. I should get home." Out the window it was dark and she was having trouble focusing. Connor moved closer, his hand successfully creeping beneath her skirt this time. "The newspapers were right," he said, whispering into her ear. "Snow was general all over Ireland." "Joyce," she whispered, turning back to him. "Yes," he said. "Joyce. I like James Joyce. So there's a writer I like." And that was it. Her resolve melted and her clenched knees unfurled like the petals of a ripening peony. She didn't think anything when he didn't call over the weekend, and told herself he must not have seen her when she walked by his locker early Monday morning.
At lunch, she strolled over to the table where he was sitting and stood for a minute, waiting for him to see her and to smile and invite her to sit. After far too many beats, after his friends were staring at her, half of them confused, half of them smirking, he looked up and raised an eyebrow.
"Hi,"
she said, trying to hold on to confusion because what came after that, she knew, was going to be worse.
"Can I help you with something, Beatrice?"
She knew her face was flooding with color. Knew she was probably flushing from head to toe. She could feel her knees sweat. Somehow she mustered enough breath and energy to turn and walk away. She heard him mumble something to the rest of the table, and they all burst out laughing, a few pounding the table in uproarious amusement. Years later, in a feminist literature class during a discussion on pornography, she would hear the term beaver for the first time, and would remember with shattering clarity the feel of that flask in her mouth, the sulfur taste of silver, the smell of whiskey and peat. She would burn with shame for days, weeks, realizing what trapper indicated, and what it had meant when Connor slid his hand beneath the elastic of her underwear that night and whispered, very much to himself,
17.
"I'm so dumb," she'd said over and over to Leo, crying and wiping her nose. "I just can't believe I was so dumb." Connor Bellingham? Leo didn't get it. That guy was a loser. "He wrote the best story," she said. "Did you read it? Did you read the last line?" "The one he lifted from The Great Gatsby? Yeah, I read it. He's lucky I didn't turn him in for plagiarizing." B didn't think it was possible to feel worse, but she bent at the waist and groaned.
"I'm so, so dumb."
Leo wrote the limerick the next day using the byline anonymous. He typed it up and made copies, and before lunch nearly the whole school had enjoyed his handiwork, featuring an unnamed student, his string of romantic conquests, and the moment in the backseat of his car when the boy would get the girl alone and inevitably, lamentably, prematurely ejaculate. The identity of the boy was obvious to the students, but so cleverly done, so easily denied, that it didn't cause trouble for Leo. And then there was this. For Connor himself to object would mean casting himself as a premature ejaculator, which Leo knew he'd never do. At first, everyone thought B was anonymous, and even though she never denied it, any number of women Connor had mistreated claimed credit for the piece and then started writing their own punishing rhymes, with Leo's subtle encouragement and often with his assistance, about Connor and soon other school miscreants. Finally, the administration stepped in and put a stop to anything by the increasingly notorious and multi-headed Anonymous that became the highlight of that school year. Later, B would think how the silly limerick was really the start of what Leo would create with Speakeasy. At the beginning, anyway, before it turned kind of desperate and dirty. She opened her Malay to one of the poems Tuck had loved and sometimes read to her. "I pray, if you love me, bear my joy." She was too antsy to read the whole thing. She refilled her cup of tea. Jesus, she was horny. How long had it been? She went into her room and rummaged through her bedside drawer for her miniature vibrator. She pulled it out and switched it on. Nothing. The batteries were dead. She looked up and saw herself standing in front of the mirror, braids sloppy and uneven from sleep. Some of the hairs around her face turned gray and wiry. She was winter pale, and her eyes were bloodshot and unfocused from the weed. Was this who she was now? A middle-aged woman with a spent vibrator and a pile of typed pages that she was hoarding like they were dead cats. She was extremely high. She could hear Lena Novak's voice as if Lena were standing in her bedroom.
"It must be hard being Beatrice Plum."
"Must be hard to be me," she said to her reflection. "Hard to be Bee." She threw the vibrator back in the drawer and went to get her coat. "Bear my joy," That's what she would say to Leo. Read these pages and tell me they're good, and let me have them and bear my fucking joy. Chapter 17. Weeks after barely graduating from college, Jack moved to Greenwich Village with a very particular goal in mind. To have sex. Lots and lots of sex. Vassar had been somewhat disappointing in that regard. At first, Jack attributed the lack of free and easy fucking that he had assumed would come with his student ID and highly coveted dorm single to statistics. A former women's college, there were fewer gay men than women on campus. Then he assumed the problem was AIDS, which was cutting a